Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode. This event was proudly supported by the Faculty of Arts, the University of Melbourne.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Russell Goulburn. I'm the Dean of the Faculty of Arts at the University of Melbourne. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you all here this evening on behalf of the Faculty of Arts and the Melbourne Writers' Festival. As I do so, I want to acknowledge that we meet on the unceded and sovereign country of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung peoples of the Kulin Nation. And I pay my respects to elders past and present and acknowledge their ongoing right and responsibility to care for country. It is, as I say, a great pleasure to welcome you all here this evening for this Bois Bouvier oration. I'm proud that we are, as a Faculty of Arts, that we collaborate with the Melbourne Writers' Festival. And I realise that the festival is drawing to a conclusion this evening, and I hope you've had a chance to attend other things as well as this session. And I hope you've had some sense of just what a fantastic festival it has been. As I say, we are very proud to be a major partner as the Faculty of Arts at the University of Melbourne of the festival. And we're a major partner precisely because our two organisations share an essential mission, which is to foster, to create, to help to build more generous, more thoughtful, more compassionate societies by pledging ourselves to the importance of the written word, by championing writing, by championing the arts of language as well. As I say, I happen to be the Dean of the Faculty of Arts, and when I think about the arts, I think about the arts of language. We give bachelors of arts and masters of arts. They are fundamentally degrees in the arts of language. And as a sign of that, well, a couple of signs of that commitment that we have to the importance of language and the written word in the faculty, one sign of that is the appointment that I made earlier this year of our first poet in residence in the faculty, Maxine Beniba-Clark, who is already making a big difference to the life of our faculty and demonstrating through her commitment, through our commitment to poetry, demonstrating that commitment to the written word and the importance of literature. Another way in which we demonstrate the importance of literature in our faculty is by our being home to the Bois Bouvier Chair in Australian Literature. It's a very special position at the University of Melbourne, and actually a special position across Australia. For a university to have an endowed chair in Australian literature, we are fortunate indeed. And I want to acknowledge that this chair, which we've held since 2015 at the University of Melbourne, is thanks to the generosity of Miriam Bois Bouvier Wiley and John Wiley, and I want to acknowledge their presence with us this evening. There have already been two very distinguished holders of that Bois Bouvier Chair of Australian Literature, Richard Flanagan and Alexis Wright. And it is my pleasure this evening to be introducing the third holder of that chair, who's going to be convening and leading this conversation that we're having this evening, who is Tony Birch. Tony, in a sense, to coin a cliche, needs no introduction, but I will introduce him anyway. You'll know Tony already as a writer, as a historian, essayist, a commentator, a teacher, an activist. Prior to joining the faculty in January this year, he held the Bruce McGuinness Professorial Fellowship at Victoria University. Tony has published three novels, two poetry collections, and five short story collections, one of which, Dark as Last Night, won the New South Wales Premier's Award Christina Stead Prize for Fiction, the Queensland Literary Awards Steel Rudd Prize, and was shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Prize. In 2017, Tony was awarded the Patrick White Literary Award, and his books have been nominated for and won many literary prizes, including the Victorian Premier's Award for Indigenous Writing and the New South Wales Premier's Award for Indigenous Writing, too. One of our ambitions that we have for the Boisbouvier Chair at the University of Melbourne is that the person who holds that chair should convene conversations such as this, should be a writer in their own right, of course, but also a writer who draws other writers to them. And that is precisely what Tony is doing for us this evening. I'll leave Tony in a moment to introduce this evening's speakers, but you'll know that what we're doing this evening is celebrating another aspect of the commitment that we have as a faculty and that we share with State Library Victoria, which is a commitment to the Writers on Writers series published by Black Ink. It's a series that I'm sure you know already that has offers such important insights into Australian writing by getting contemporary writers to reflect on fellow writers. It's a very distinctive way of appreciating the importance of Australian literary culture, and it's great to be having this opportunity this evening to reflect further on that series. So without further ado, I will hand over to Tony to introduce the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Russell, for those words. There's a few things I want to say at the outset this evening. Firstly, as Russell just alluded to, I wanted to build this conversation around the Writers on Writers series that is under the publication of Black Ink through Chris Fike, who holds the ship in good stead. It's a wonderful series that has been produced by Black Ink in partnership with the University of Melbourne and the institution that we're in this evening, the State Library of Victoria. The titles, if you don't know them, and some of the books will certainly be available if you want to purchase the backlist in the book room afterwards. Alice Pung's essay on John Marsden, Sean O'Byrne's essay on Helen Garner, and one of our guests today, Nam Lee, who wrote a wonderful essay on David Malouf. So my own role here today is twofold. It is, of course, as has just been alluded to, in my position of Boisbouvier Chair, generously supported by John and Miriam, to get us to talk about Australian writing and get us to talk about that in relationship to these wonderful collection of essays. The other thing I think that is probably invaluable for me to say at the outset is that when I thought about applying for this position and thinking about the role of a public intellectual and academic in a university environment, what I was most attracted to was, through again John and Marion's wishes, to not only work within the university, engage with university students, undergraduates and postgraduates, which I'm doing, but to consider my role not only beyond the arts faculty, where I'm located, but and the university community more generally, but more importantly to the communities outside the university. And I won't go into detail, we don't have enough time, but just to give you a sense of what I'm able to do because of the support, I'm involved in several major projects that we've already commenced that we wanted to make sure we hit the ground running with. We have just finished the first semester of teaching with second year medical students in the medical faculty at Melbourne University, teaching a course on narrative medicine, me being brought in as a creative writer to engage medical students about the vitality of listening to and understanding someone's story when they come in to see you as a patient, and doing that by engaging people to think about what storytelling is, what does it mean, and these wonderful young students that we've worked with of having a great passion not only for their own creative writing, but for understanding how important it is to share stories. So we've finished one group of students and we commence a second cohort of students next Tuesday. And I was just saying to Kate how rewarding that has been. Secondly, that I'm very fortunate as part of this role to begin a three-year project, which have already started, with a state school in Melbourne's northern suburbs, Preston Secondary College. And we're working for 3 years, we'll be working with the year nine cohort to engage students in a greater appreciation of Australian literature, but also to enhance their passion for reading. And that is driven by a remarkable principal out there, Sean Butler, who was an ex-student of mine at Melbourne University, a very dynamic principal, and that is one of my second major projects. And just to say, and I won't take up any more time, but there are many other aspects to my position that allow me to work in and outside a university doing what I love, and that is to engage students and communities like yourself with writing. So I want to thank John and Miriam personally very much for that. The second thing I want to talk about is that Chris Fike, as his role of commissioning writers to write about writers, we had a dinner earlier in the year, and I had a gentle complaint to Chris that no one has written a Writers on Writers book about Kim Scott, twice winner of the Miles Franklin Award, first certainly First Nations writer to do so, and I thought it was really important that a writer write about Kim Scott. And of course, the first thing Chris said, well, you'll have to do that. So again, through my position in the chair, I've finished the draft of that book or that long essay. Again, the position allows me to do these things, and recently I was also able to publish a longish essay on Alexis Wright, who I love dearly, in the Monthly. So it's allowed me, I suppose, for want of a better term, the public intellectual side of my position is to be able to engage people with writers. And we'll go on to this when we talk to Nam Lee, but I would just say, as a writer, writing on a writer, I did say to Nam and to Chris and Kate earlier, I know Kim Scott very well personally, and I know his work very well, but being asked to write a book about him, the insights that I gained into my own understanding of his work were just heightened so much. And so it's been a pleasure for me to be able to do that. And again, I wouldn't be able to do that without holding this position. So I feel very fortunate. So I want to now introduce our guests. You'll see that their bios get longer as we go through the list. But even Nam's is not too long. I had one earlier today, it was like an essay. So Chris Fike. Chris Fike is a senior publisher of Black Ink and editor of Quarterly Essay. He is commissioning editor of the Writers on Writers series, and he's a co-editor of the book The Words That Made Australia. Secondly, our guest is... Oh, do you want me to go in order, Kate? Yeah, I'll go Nam.
However you like.
Kate. So Nam Lee's first book, The Boat, received the Australian Prime Minister's Literary Award, the Melbourne Award, Best Writing Award, the Dylan Thomas Prize, the Ainsfield Wolf Book Award, we'll just go on and on here, the Penn Melamud Award, amongst many other honours. It was also selected as a New York Times Notable Book and Editor's Choice, the Best Debut of 2008 by the Australian Book Review and New York Magazine, and a Book of the Year by The Age. We'll keep going. The Sydney Morning Herald, The Australian, The Herald Sun, and The Monthly, and numerous sources around the world. If I ever had writer's envy, I've got it right now. The Boat has been translated into 13 languages and its stories widely anthologized. Lee is a fiction editor at Harvard Review. And our final guest, Kate Evans. Kate Evans is the co-host of the ABC Radio National Weekly Literary Review and Interview Program, The Bookshelf. She also contributes to other programs on the network and regularly hosts interviews at writers' festivals. She has a PhD in history and too many books and regrets neither. Good. So could you please make our guests welcome? Now, you will note that my voice is... this is my fourth panel. I had a very bad cold all of last week, which I overcame, and then went to the football on Friday night to try and raise Carlton from the dead, and did not succeed. So I hope these people are going to talk a lot and I don't have to talk too much. So I want to start with you, Chris, and a very straightforward question. What was the philosophy and what was the impetus about beginning the series?
Yeah,
Well, the impetus was simple. An old friend of mine, Meredith Martin, was at Melbourne University working in partnerships, and she wanted to do more with the State Library, and she came to Black Ink and said, would you be interested in doing a Writers on Writers series? She was a little bit inspired by Princeton University Press, which had done something similar. Though, to be honest, I've actually never looked at what they did. So we took it from there, and it was a little bit... it took on a life of its own very quickly, and I thought about why that was. I'll read you a little bit. I would write to the writers with a short brief, and this is, I'd say, the brief is very open, but the basic idea is that they are written from the perspective of the reader and practitioner, not scholarly monographs. The idea is to create an enlivening encounter between past and present, to think about art and craft, to show what reading our talented forebears can open up to us, fascination, hope, trouble. We hope each book will have its own flavour, voice, approach. Some of the best of them have been a kind of camouflage credo. So that was some very general settings for people. But the key decision, I realised later on, was just to let the writers choose their subjects. Because sometimes it's quite hard to write, it's often to write praise for, it's easy to criticise, it's harder to write praise that's interesting, was a rule I had in mind, but actually it was the opposite, because when people wrote about things that they loved or that preoccupied and fascinated them, the series came to life. So in almost every case, the subject was chosen by the writer. And in the best of them, you can feel that thing you said before, whereas the writer is discovering on the page what interested them about this writer, or maybe they don't like them as much as they did, maybe they like them more, maybe they understand their achievement more, maybe they see themselves reflected. And then the other thing that's interesting is that the books become mirrors as well. So they're both portraits of another writer, but then the writer reveals themselves in writing the book. Yeah.
You want to keep going?
No, that's enough.
So one of the things, obviously, when you look at the series, as a writer, so when I talked to Chris about where's Kim Scott and where's Alexis Wright, obviously I have a particular bias coming out here. Clearly, for many readers, you could look at a series and say, "Yeah, who's not here?" Which is really unfair, because we should be saying, "Well, who is here and how important that is." You talked about writers choosing a subject, but I suppose I'm interested in. I know you're a really passionate reader and a literary person. Were there writers that you hoped would be chosen, or were there times when you suggested that possibly there'd be someone you'd want someone to write on, or was that totally left to the writer?
Good question. Look, I actually always would have liked to publish something on Les Murray. There's not enough poetry in the selection so far. I think that would have been good. Often I'd have an idea in the back of my mind. I knew that Michelle de Kretzer was obsessively interested in Shirley Hazzard. Mm-hmm. And Alice Pung said to me, she'd had lunch with Nam Lee, and she said to Nam, if you could write on a writer, who would you write about? And she said, Nam had said David Maloof, so I immediately sent an email to Nam saying, would you like to write on David Maloof? And there were cases where a few people said, I would like to write on Helen Garner or somebody else, and I said, well, Helen's taken, so would you write on somebody else? Okay. So there are a couple of people who cropped up regularly as well, Helen really, who people wanted to write about.
Okay, so I did have a question for Nam Lee, why Maloof, and it's because of Alice Pung. But it's a really good moment, because that was the question, Nam. So I've read most of the books, and I had read Nam Lee's and gone to a wonderful conversation between Christos Tsolkas and Nam Lee talking about David Maloof's book. And, of course, I then reread Nam's essay for this conversation. Why David Maloof? So if someone said, well, who would you like to write, and you said David Maloof, what was it about Maloof that I suppose, attracted you before you wrote the book, and what, to take Chris's point, what did you learn about yourself as a reader of Maloof and Maloof as a writer during the process?
Oh, geez, I learned a few things. One was that having lunch with Alice Pung could be quite an expensive proposition in terms of, you know, a year taken up writing a book. I guess I also learned that David Maloof had written so many books, more than I had realised when I, you know, I have this sort of dullard's habit towards completism, and when I do a review or anything, a launch, an introduction, I tend to feel obliged to read the entire sort of, you know, back catalogue. And had I known that Maloof's back catalogue was actually twice as long and took, you know, twice as many pages, I might have reconsidered either my ethos or the project. I think it's pretty simple in my case. It was because I love his work. I just think he's an extraordinary writer. I think it's hard to sort of cast one's mind back now to then, and, you know, I'm going to be tendentious as I do so, but it felt to me, at least at the time, that there was a kind of petering away of interest in Maloof, or certainly a sense that he was being sort of resigned to the past. And I thought that what he was doing in his writing, because obviously writing is in the ever now when you're reading it, was and is as brave and current and interesting and beautiful as anyone was doing, certainly in terms of ambition of subject matter, beauty of execution. The fact that he's a poet also spoke really deeply to me, because that's sort of where I started as well. So it was, you know, when Alice asked that question, I wasn't thinking of it in terms of who might be a good fit for me to bang my head against for a while. It was just more an unconsidered, you know, assertion of love.
I mean, I love that you're talking about your beginning as a poet. There's a lovely, because there's a wonderful, I think, personal, intimate angle to this book. So you're at a scholarship boy, I think the term is, at a private school. And I don't know if you're a poetry snob or a poetry nerd, but can you tell people about really your love of poetry at the time and the people you were reading? Because, and I don't want to get, I mean, thinking of your background and where you've come from and where you are, I just love the idea of who you were reading at school.
I was, the horizons, both material and conceptual for me, I had no idea they were so constricted at the time. And so I might go into a secondhand bookstore, as, you know, you did every day after school. And if you looked at the poetry shelf, it was basically, it was Norton, you know, it was Palgrave, it was Golden Treasury, it was the English Romantics. And you might get up to some American modernists and, you know, a little bit after that. But it was, you know, I sort of cut my teeth as like a good little colonial English schoolboy. Like, I was reading, you know, Keats and Coleridge and Shelley and Tennyson and Browning and Donne and, you know, all the metaphysics. Like, I just love that stuff. And for me, it didn't feel constrictive at all, because obviously within each of those schools or fields, there was an infinity of practice and theory. And I, you know, I couldn't get enough of it.
I mean, it's like when I'm reading it, it's like a Dead Poets Society moment almost. It's so wonderful. Now, Kate Evans, many reasons, but one of the reasons I wanted to ask Kate onto the panel was Kate reads many books every week.
I do.
Interviews writers, talk to readers. One of the things that we find, Kate, often is, you know, people often talk about a crisis in Australian literature, or, you know, and it's not apparent to me. So that a good example is when I published my first book in 2006, Shadowboxing. It was a collection of short stories. Kate Kennedy published Dark Roots in the same year. Namely hadn't come along with the boat and broken the mould. And people said, oh, most people said they won't publish short stories. Scribe did publish both of us that year, but the number of Australian books actually published by Australian authors was nothing in comparison to what's happening now. So as a writer, I feel it's a much more vibrant world. As someone who engages with Australian and international writing as part of your brief, what's your sense of the state of writing in Australia, you know, as part of the culture? I do want to ask you in a moment about sort of popular literature, but how healthy or unhealthy do you think Australian writing is at the moment?
Look, it's such a, I mean, it's such a difficult but vital question, because it feels vibrant to me, because since the COVID lockdown, all of the books come to me at home, which means that every day I get couriers and the postie, like they all know my name, and I get dozens and dozens and dozens of books every week that I have to read. So it feels vibrant to me, but also a lot of the claims that are made about the state of writing and the state of publishing, it could hardly be more unscientific, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not based on anything but people looking at what they like or what they don't like. And if they were to judge it on things like what gets reviewed, the crisis is really in reviewing and the media. I mean, I try to read what is reviewed in the Sydney Morning Herald, because I live in Sydney, the Sydney Morning Herald and the Australian every week, and those pages have just shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And some weeks there is no fiction reviewed, which is just terrible. The other mythology that I think happens about Australian fiction that I think is actually belied by your series is that this is a community of people who undermine and fight and compete with each other. And what this series shows, I think, is the generosity of writers to each other, which for us as readers leads to a deeper reading. I mean, I've read, I don't know, think I've read all of them, but I have read many of this series, and it's a way to take you back to those writers who are the subjects, but it also introduces you in a different way to the writers themselves, because you're seeing them as essayists and storytellers and memoirists. I love how idiosyncratic this series is. And I also ask writers every week to come onto the show and review other writers. Now, the danger there is I do not ask Australian writers to review other Australian writers, partly because it's a small community, partly because I frankly don't know who is somebody's ex, who is somebody's nemesis, who's sleeping with somebody else, and I'm not going to take that risk. So I ask Australian writers to review overseas authors. But it feels dynamic to me because I think you can still be surprised by what's happening. You can read, you can see something quite unexpected, like the unicorn of Australian publishing in the last couple of years, which is Michael Winkler's book Grimish, because it was self-published.
Yep.
Can I just reveal what the downside of that is? It means I get sent even more self-published books. Please don't, just as a note. I think there's a reason that publishers and gatekeepers exist, to be honest. But having said that, I mean, it's an audacious piece of writing. It's experimental. There's a lot of experimental writing that happens at the short fiction level. It's still happening in small journals. But then genre fiction, too, is really vibrant. I mean, to be honest, the most number of books I get every single week is crime fiction.
I was going to ask you about that because we know there's been phenomenal... Well, it's always been a staple. So if we look at writers like Chris Hammer and Jane Harper, obviously we're having phenomenal success in Australia and internationally. I am a devotee of Gary Disher. That's why ABR always get me to review his novels each December. It's like a Christmas present. And Gary knows that he's going to get a good copy. Because when I read Disher's fiction, his crime fiction set on the Mornington Peninsula, and you think it's not all beach boxes down there, bathing boxes. I know it's crime genre, but I still think Disher's crime writing, it gives me great insights into Australian culture. When my son-in-law moved with my daughter to Melbourne last year, the first book I gave him was Peter Temple's Truth, which is a great book. How do you see that as a journalist and a reader and reviewer of the notion of, say, crime genre's popularity? Can it still provide us with insights into Australian culture that might otherwise be dismissed as popular culture?
Look, I think genre fiction is really important, and partly because there's a lot of crime fiction and speculative and fantasy fiction that knows what its genre does and does it very well. But crime fiction, I think, is a form that is all about place. City-based crime fiction goes in and out of all levels of society. It's what it does. It's part of what the genre allows. And so I think it does that in Australian fiction as well. But let's face it, it appears that there are secrets in Australian country towns. And I have never seen so many books that have that as a tagline and expect us to be surprised that there are secrets and underbellies and undercurrents in Australian towns. Whereas I think 15 years ago they were more city-based crimes. So it is, I mean, it's always possible to write a fantastic piece of crime fiction. But I meet with publishers a number of times a year, and one of the things I say to them is, please don't tell me that there's a buzz around this debut novel. That doesn't tell me anything. And you see them quietly going, okay, just crossing that out. And also, don't send me all of the exact same format crime novels with the exact same cover and same style, because it means you'll actually miss the good one.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, some weeks I do get 10 of them a week and I can't read them all, and I'm wanting to do a really wide range of fiction justice. And you do see the patterns. And lately it's, and again, there's brilliant work that is coming of age fiction set on university campuses. But we're getting a bit of a run of them. But it's also because that's what publishers are doing or seeing the success of, and then they do it again with graphic design.
Yeah.
So you can go, oh, that's, you think that's like that. And it's also, I think, something that they should stop doing. This is like Sally Rooney.
Yeah.
Or the worst, actually, is if they say this is the... Actually, they used to do it more in the 80s and 90s. The bastard love child of... And two completely unlikely things, you know, Hilary Mantel and James Ellroy.
Interesting that with covers of Sally Rooney's Ordinary People, when you see those coming of age in a city campus, you just could tell by looking at the covers, oh, that's about that, because that looks like a Sally Rooney cover. Mm. Having said that about, you know, all these secrets in Australian country towns, nothing's as bad as Midsummer Murders. Imagine how many people get killed in that. And my wife Sarah, who's English, she always says, it's not a town, Tony, it's a county. A lot can happen in a county. Back to you, Nam. I think there's wonderful tension in your essay. And again, I think, when you love Maloof, I think you said three times, and it's clear the passion. But there is a moment in the essay early on when you say, we submitted to the Oz lit foisted upon us at school, which you call shoddy nationalism, the black hole of nationality. There is a valuable tension in your essay, I say, between that love of Maloof and, in a way, a label of Australian writing or a label of national literature, which itself is constricting, or it seems to be. Could you talk to that? Because it's certainly not, it's not a shallow criticism. I think it's a tension in you as both a reader and a writer.
Yeah, I think there are levels and there are levels. The superficial level is that as a schoolboy who is trying to grow his autonomy and his sense of self, having things foisted on you, saying, you know, you must read this or you must read that, and you must basically valorize or think or prize this in this way, is a surefire way to have that person read it with a very, very sort of gimlet eye. And so at the time, it was just post-bicentennial, and I think there was a real sort of push to
triumphalize Australian literature. And so as a school kid in these English and Lit classes, you know, you sort of felt just deluged by, you know, Auslit. And it felt at the time that there was another purpose that was being prioritized rather than, you know, what you sit in a literature class for. There was an ulteriority to what was happening. And I think that that's maybe that's the through line for me, you know, just thinking about these essays, which I wrote quite a while ago. The through line, perhaps, is that the idea that literature is instrumentalized is sort of taken and used as a tool to an end that is outside of what the thing itself is trying to achieve feels to me more and more bad, I think. And I think there are levels and levels of badness, but, you know, even with the best of intentions, trying to assert an identity, whether that's a cultural nationalist identity or a different identity, and having that be, you know, the front foot with which you lead the reader on this journey, I think that can have unintended consequences, because you might actually sort of be pulling the rug out from all of the sort of other mainstays and structures that we have come to understand and consensualize as this is why we value the thing that we're doing, and this is why this thing is unlike this thing, and this is why this thing is more sophisticated or thought through than this other thing. You know, once you instrumentalize, you're sort of putting that aside and sort of saying, well, hang on, you should be thinking this about that. And I think that's where the tension, which I only discovered as I was sort of going through the body of work that Malouf had produced, including a lot of his nonfiction, his essays, and his occasional work as well, his speeches and lectures, there was and is this sense that he saw and sees Australian letters as a landscape that is there for the taking. It is yet to be instantiated. And so much of what he calls cultural nationalism, I just didn't jibe with. I didn't dig, you know, for a bunch of reasons. And we can talk about that. But there were first principle objections in the sense even of like the sense that the European consciousness was coming to this place and then overlaying or taking possession of, again, words that and figures that figure quite prominently in a lot of his writings. From that through basically, you know, white Australia policy through to where we are now, I just felt as though there were huge sort of chunks of the picture that were missing and that were willfully occluded as well.
It's interesting because I remember talking to David at Mildura Writers Festival several years ago on a panel. He was very generous. And I remember he said, when you're writing, the only thing that matters is, you know, the only authenticity, the integrity is in the writing, the story. You know, don't get influenced by these other... It might seem almost a flippant question, but I was interested, particularly as Malouf, as a figure of Australian letters. Going back over that body of work, if you were, say, to present, you know, a novel of David Malouf, a collection of his essays, a book of poetry, to an international reader, a visitor, what concept of Australia do you think people would get out of his work?
Well, it's funny because he, you know, going through that body of work, his work actually touches on, I would argue, maybe every single one of the nodes and the potent sort of touch points of what Australians might consider their national narrative, their cultural story, you know, from European arrival. So there's like, you know, sort of first contact and then, you know, the war, but you've got all of these sort of points in between where he's very deliberately exploring. And then he explores in allegorical and metaphorical form as well, you know, with imaginary life, etc. These are really consciously and intensely, intelligently thought through structures of idea, of placement, of thought, and of narrative. And he speaks in his nonfiction about this idea of a narrative. And I think that, you know, the narrative that an outsider might see would be pretty similar to the one that we might see, because it dovetails with the notions that we have and understand about Australian-ness as well. And so, like, you know, the Anzacs would figure very prominently. And, you know, in terms of, like, the first contact sort of situations, very, you know, nuanced and euphemistic, I guess. But it's definitely there, and it's not unsophisticated. Mm-hmm. But I guess my problem is that narratives are dangerous things. They can be shaped. That's the whole point of a narrative. They can be manipulated. They can be distorted. They can feel exclusive. They can exclude. And they can create a sense of outerness. They can you know, chuck up the borders. And maybe writers should be the last people that we should trust with narratives as well. And so for me, it's this sense of, I don't know. I don't think, I'm capturing the soul of Australia when I'm writing. Oh, I'm really sort of doing justice to this quintessence of this country. I just think it's too big, it's too varied, it's too energetic for that. And I kind of love that. And of course, that's not to say that what is done, if it's done well, out of good faith, with, like, you know, detail and love, can't be, you know, an amazing sort of part portrait of Australia. But the notion of always sticking the nationalist label or looking at things through the nationalist lens, I find is, you know, potentially very constricting. And I think some writers do it really well and invite it, and others, you couldn't be further from the intention of the work. And I think there should be an element of volition.
Yep, thank you very much for that. Chris, I'll start with you and I'll go to Kate. I want to talk about dead white males, because Nam brings it up in the essay where he says, I like this, I want to explore this with reference to two issues that Nam raised. I'm talking about myself now. I'm quoting myself. What he says, hanging out with the wrong crowd of dead white guys. And of course, what we know that David Malouf is still with us. But I think metaphorically, I think one of the things that I appreciate with the essay is the whole notion, and Nam, I think, does a really good job on the superficiality of so-called culture wars, I think, really well. Just to preference this, I was in a series of talks given by candidates for a creative writing job at Melbourne University 2 weeks ago, and one of the candidates gave a wonderful presentation, and it was about the need to look at texts that may become difficult, or to always look at writers who may be seen differently, you know, in the current political climate, and the whole notion that you would not read or you throw out writers because they don't quite fit the current political climate was dangerous. And I know, Chris, that both thinking about some of the writers in the series and, you know, mentioning Les Murray, who, Les Murray, by the way, taught me how to paint a wall red. If you've got white undercoat still coming through, you put grey in the undercoat, but that's another story. As a publisher and thinking about this series, and I'll go to Kate and back to Nam, how do you think we deal with this current issue, which is a real political issue, but the fact that, you know, Nam was reading Yeats, Keats. I have a great history of reading, you know, a lot of dead white people who I love, and Alexis Wright, one of my mentors, if you read any of Alexis's work, she has incredible depth of reading and talks about her mentors and teachers and people like Seamus Heaney, for instance. So clearly, for us as writers, the notion that we don't read writers because they don't fit whatever political climate we're in, we don't subscribe to it. But how, as a publisher, do you need to be sensitive both to changes and to give due recognition of those who have come before us, because the issue is real.
Yeah. Well, I don't have to deal with it except insofar as I tried to create... I encourage interesting matchups in the sense that... So when Alice said, I'd like to write on John Marsden, I thought, well, that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. When Christos said, I've been reading Patrick White for a whole year now, Fred isn't, and the theme of his thing is how does a migrant write about a sort of patrician settler type, and what do they have in common, what don't they have in common? Mm-hmm. And when I learnt that Stan Grant was obsessed with The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, both the original Jimmy Governor story and the Thomas Keneally thing, something interesting is going to happen when you put those things together. And I think that's a better thing than saying, well, we're not really interested in Patrick White anymore. Mm-hmm. It's much
Which
better.
Which is what they said at Melbourne University.
Indeed, yeah. so it's just trying to create situations where you can have that mirroring but also difference. And, of course, there's a historical aspect to that as well, because things were different then and you have to understand how they were different and also how they're the same. And so that's, for my role is very simple, which is just to have interesting commissioning, and then it's up to Nam to figure it out from there.
I mean, I think that's a really invaluable, Chris. And Kate, maybe if I could sort of frame the question then a little differently, because I imagine from your perspective as a broadcaster and journalist, that when we have these tensions, that taking Chris's point about those seemingly odd but dynamic matches, it seems to lean towards the fact that you can have really dynamic conversations about the tensions that we're dealing with, very healthy, informed, energetic discussions.
Yeah, and there's a couple of ways of answering that, I guess. I mean, some of it is that it feels dynamic when you put, in our case, an older book next to a new one. So, for example, last year or the year before, we did a book club discussion with Gail Jones's the book before last, the one that was set in Western Australia, and put it next to a Randolph Stowe novel, because the way in which those works were different and had points of connection was really fresh, but it also is a way to expand the potential reading of our audience. So you end up doing a whole lot of curious things about who your imagined audience is on the one hand, and what it is that, I guess it's not just an ABC audience, what a Radio National audience is interested in. And just as a slight aside, I mean, the ABC has a really rich archive of literary conversations. And one of the things in the program, the weekly program, The Bookshelf, is that it's all about new releases. And you end up getting slightly obsessed with wanting to, like, you know, we work months ahead in assigning the books, but that this book is released this week, so let's review it this week or next week. And sometimes you think, oh, have we missed the moment because that book was out 5 weeks ago? Of course, that's not how readers read. Mm. They might have to wait till it's in the library or finding a book in a secondhand bookshop or hearing about this book 3 years later and somebody says, you must read it. Have you read The Boat? No, I haven't. You must. And so there was a project that we initiated of getting what we saw as sort of classic Australian novels onto the ABC Listen app. And I think there were about 8 interviews. And that included Alexis Wright, Peter Carey, Helen Garner. The spikes in listenership just went whoosh through the roof. People wanted to be thinking about these books that sometimes they knew were important and they knew these writers were important, or that they felt they were, and they wanted more. They wanted information. And what I've really noticed is, alongside an interest in fiction, there's a big interest in history and in learning things, and then in, from the media perspective, and what they call explainer media, where people want to know stuff. Mm. And so if they don't know why Patrick White's important, and generationally some groups won't know why Patrick White's important, they respond really strongly to expertise and specialisation and those discussions. And I think it's also really important that we both don't turn away from them and don't get too simplistic in our judgment and conversations about them, which isn't to say that you shouldn't have feisty people saying, this is a lot of old bollocks and why are we reading this and isn't it just racist crap? But then having somebody else say, let's have a look at this writing. What can you get from it? Why does it still matter? And to keep that as a dynamic conversation. And it's not always easy to do, of course, but the best of those conversations aren't easy to do and can make you a little uncomfortable. And I think that that's a line that we have to keep returning to, the slightly uncomfortable conversations.
Which is interesting because this, I don't know if people know that the candidate who I can say successfully got the position is a Melbourne writer, Quinn Eads. And what they said was about discomfort, that we need to deal with discomfort. I suppose the caveat or the proviso for Quinn was, as a teacher, and I know this as a teacher, I've taught Aboriginal history and Australian history, you could be in a room where you want to have a discussion about, you know, colonial violence, and it can collapse really quickly into a very unhealthy environment. So rather than go from an intellectual tension that's helpful and valuable, you could find yourself in a very difficult position very quickly. And one of the things that Quinn Eads said is that we need to have conversations of discomfort or continue to read writers who, you know, there are questions. But Quinn did say, I think it's important, is therefore as teachers, we need to think about the responsibility of how we care for that. And I don't mean that in a sort of soft and cuddly way, but if I'm a teacher, I'm going to ask my students to think intelligently, sort of in a sophisticated way, an engaging way about these, I need, as a teacher, to create that space for that to happen. I think that was really important. I've got one more question, but if I've missed anything you want to add and sum up, please do, before Russell closes. It is a general question, but in your roles as whatever you want to call yourself, publisher, writer, journalist, reader, PhD, holder of history, where do you think we're at with our writing culture in Australia going forward? So in the publishing industry, I know that Namely is incredibly widely read as well, of course, writing. And Kate, to take that question of, you know, what is it a healthy environment? What's going to happen next? Where are we going? And we don't need to mention AI. That's a more frightening conversation to have elsewhere. So where do you reckon we're going, Chris?
Gosh, I'm a mere practitioner, so I just one foot in front of the other.
You're the money man.
Yeah. Well, the commissioning as well. I agree that it is basically healthy because we have so many more interesting voices in Australia, and Australia's perhaps become a more interesting place over time as well. So I think we could be more confident about that in some ways, about what's distinctive about the country and all the many different ways it's distinctive. I've found that some of the most successful books I've published have been books that hit a social nerve of some kind. And it's usually about a conflict between generations or things that people didn't know but they wanted to know about. So I think the more we can do that, the better. And that will inevitably be discomforting on occasion. But I suppose comfort is the enemy to some extent for a healthy culture.
Yeah.
So, but I think we've got enough appetite for discomfort for it to be a healthy situation overall.
Don't worry about that. Happens every night at 5:30, whatever that man was saying. Ma'am?
Oh, geez. I think it's always... it's always astounding to me, you know, every time we do one of these things or even just go into a university or, you know, do an event, that you just meet so many people who are writing. Like, we live, we're swamped by writers, to steal elocution. And to me, the reservation that I have, or the worry that I have, I guess I would say, goes back to that metaphor of the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we're wanting for good writers. I don't think we're wanting for readers. I don't think we're wanting for a larger, apparatus or infrastructure. The amount of zines and journals and, online sort of fora that are propping up all the time. But I do think that in order for that to have a stability and a longevity, we need to ask ourselves the questions of what it is about letters that we value and how do we come to some sort of common ground agreeing about that value or arguing about that value going forward. Because at the moment, I think there's a real sense, probably been building for a while, but there's a sense of, what is literature for? Is it to prove that we can punch, above our weight? Is it to foment a national identity or a sense of continuity or redemption or catharsis even, is it to sort of show us where we should be going? So a utopic sort of vision, which is, getting more traction now, wherein people don't want to read things that show things that are deemed problematic because despite the fact that things are problematic, everyone agrees, we can't actually show them because mimetically what you're doing is you're agreeing or sanctioning them in some way. I think that's an issue. And so all of these things sort of compounded with, the review culture or the critical culture, where on the one side you have, why would you ever write a bad review? Because, we're so precarious in this field. Let's just love on. And on the other side, you've got the small pondism and internecine kind of like the more low the stakes, the more vicious the knife fighting that you get in certain literary circles as well. And then the commercial precarity in the middle, where we're not really sure structurally, globally, what's happening. I think there's a lot of words being written and spent that may not be doing that ecosystem good. I think there are a lot of words being said and written that are in some ways written in with a little bit of bad faith, or certainly with intentions that are other than like valuing literature as the reason why we came into this in the first place. So that's where my concern is. I think it's the stuff around it.
Yep. Kate?
Well, I cannot be as elegant as Nam, but I will do my best. Look, my inclination is to be optimistic, but on the other hand, I do speak to publishers who are having all sorts of financial crises. I am concerned about the gallery, libraries and museum and even university sectors. And as part of the public broadcaster, we're also being stretched and stretched and stretched. And this is part of the infrastructure that we need to encourage. As you say, there's plenty of writing, there's plenty of audacious thinking, there's really innovative stuff that happens in the creative nonfiction area. And so, just to be screamingly obvious, we have to keep on encouraging critical and engaged and diverse reading. We need good readers, and we have to have that dynamic critical culture as well. I mean, I've got no answer for it except for wanting to be optimistic and then occasionally thinking, really, what's happening when we aren't seeing the, the reviews or the grants or the Australian literature programs at universities? Mm-hmm. My tendency is optimism, but I occasionally veer the other way. But yeah. I have no answer.
I mean, to close, and we're going to invite Russell Goldberg back up to close formally, but I think that's an interesting point about universities, because I was teaching at Melbourne University when people beat Patrick White to death, and it's actually cheap behaviour, I think, because if you're going to talk about a writer who you feel is no longer relevant, you should be able to defend that intellectually rather than be flippant about it. And there's a lot of flippancy when these things occur. Which, to go back to Nam's essay, I think my love of the essay was the way that you wrote about Malouf with such respect, and you did raise issues of questions. You questioned that, cultural nationalism that he champions. And I think that Nam's is a great example of someone, a writer, working so intelligently and with respect to another writer. I wanted to say, because I won't be speaking again, I want to thank each of the three people. They were my immediate wish list, and I got my wish straight away. So I just want to thank you all, and I want to invite Russell Goldburn back up just to close for the afternoon. Russell.
Thank you very much indeed. It's on your behalf, ladies and gentlemen, I just want to say a few words of thanks. Kate, you talked earlier on about the, as those many books arrive and the choices that you have to make about what to read, the choices we all have to make about what to read, we make choices about which sessions in literary festivals to attend as well. And I hope you feel that you've made a good choice, the right choice, in the session that you've attended here. There was so much that I enjoyed this evening. Kate, you've also underscored the importance of keeping open spaces for these kind of ideas, for spaces for talking about literature, spaces on radio, spaces in the written media as well, and spaces like this are so important. And that's why we were reflecting on the Writers on Writers series, because that, in its idiosyncratic way, I think that was a word, again, you used, Kate, carves out precisely that space for thinking about books and the value of literature. We've heard in the course of this evening's conversation so many insights into the writing process and also the joyous act of reading and engaging with texts as well. Nam talked about the ethos of writing, and we've had a window into the ethical concerns of the writer and the reader as well. This Writers on Writers series, it seems to me, is a series that stages precisely the kind of dialogue, the kind of conversation that is inherent to literature itself. We've had a sense this evening of just how no writer can write in glorious isolation from others. And Tony, you evoked earlier on I think the depth of reading, I think you said, that characterizes Alexis Wright's reading. We know from our own experience that when we read a book that the words on the page bristle with echoes of other texts, intentionally or otherwise, of course, but they bristle with echoes of texts that have meaning for us, that potentially have meaning for the writers as well. And we've really been taken deep, I think, this evening into that experience of reading, and particularly the work that fiction does, the work that fiction does on us as individuals, but also the work that it can do collectively in a society, the good that literature can do collectively in society as well. And that sense of optimism that we heard about towards the end is really striking. Chris, at the outset, in introducing the series that's been at the heart of this conversation, said that the aim of the series was to provoke fascination, hope, and trouble. I hope this conversation this evening has provoked those same feelings and emotions, fascination, hope, trouble. There's nothing wrong with being a little bit troubled, a little bit discomforted. Certainly I found this evening fascinating, and it fills us with hope, I think, for the future of Australian literary culture. So as Tony mentioned earlier on, we can go out into the Hanson Hall. Nam has very kindly agreed to sign copies of his books that are there. There are also copies of other volumes in the Writers on Writers series. So please do go through there and maybe catch up with our participants. But finally, please join me in thanking in the usual way our speakers this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.